UN confirms a report that a top Saudi official made a death threat against a UN rapporteur in charge of a probe into the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. North Korea reportedly fires two projectiles suspected to be ballistic missiles just a few days after it launched two short-range missiles. Also ahead, Palestinian groups say they have hold out little hope for a change in Tel Aviv's policies towards Palestinians following the latest Israeli elections. It's good to have you with us. Our top story, the UN Human Rights Office confirms remarks by UN expert Agnes Callamard that she was threatened by the Saudis for her role in the Khashoggi investigation. Callamard said a colleague alerted her that a Saudi official had threatened to have her, quote, taken care of. The UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Summary and Arbitrary Killing says the officials in the room had considered the remarks as a death threat. In a report published in June 2019, Callamard said Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi's death constituted an extrajudicial killing for which Saudi Arabia is responsible. U.S. intelligence reports also concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved and probably ordered the assassination of Khashoggi in the kingdom's Istanbul consulate in late 2018. Political commentator Lawrence Davison says the U.S. reaction to the Saudi threat against a top UN expert will not go beyond a verbal admonition.
There'll be nothing from the U.S. State Department about this. At least nothing. Well, they might offer some verbiage about it, but there'll be no effective action. Okay? And this is because Saudi Arabia has these massive investments in the United States. So Saudi Arabia is in a position essentially to retaliate against the United States economically if they are pushed by Washington. And so essentially they're being blackmailed. Washington's being blackmailed by this. And that's how they get away with it.
Yemen has released footage of the moment when the army intercepted an intruding drone flying over the strategic province of Ma'rib. Yemeni forces shot down the unmanned aerial vehicle with a surface-to-air missile on Tuesday. The drone was a sophisticated US-made MQ-9. It is not yet clear which country operated the drone. Over the past few weeks, Ma'rib has been the scene of large-scale operations. Yemeni army units and allied Ansar Allah fighters are pushing against Saudi-led militants loyal to former President Abd Rabbuh Mansour Hadi. After 6 years of deadly war on Yemen, a new report has been issued by a human rights center about war crimes committed during the conflict and civilian casualties inflicted by the Saudi-led coalition. More details from our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif al-Washadi, in this report.
In a press conference, Yemen's Eye of Humanity Center for Rights and Development revealed the number of victims of 6 years of Saudi war on the country, which has also caused massive destruction to the infrastructure of the country.
There are 43,593 civilians killed and wounded during the past 6 years. 17,097 of them were killed, including 3,821 children and 2,394 women. As for the wounded, they numbered 26,496, including 4,183 children and 2,1815 women.
The center says Saudi airstrikes targeted thousands of civilian facilities deliberately, including hospitals and schools. Meanwhile, millions of families were displaced as over 500,000 homes were ruined in more than 20 governorates.
This report monitored the crimes and violations committed by the Saudi-led coalition against civilians in Yemen, as well as the destruction and damage resulted from the brutal targeting of thousands of civilian installations, including homes, hospitals, schools, mosques, roads, bridges, and historical monuments. Even the cemeteries were not spared.
During 6 years of war, Saudi Arabia committed thousands of violations of international humanitarian law, including using internationally prohibited weapons such as cluster bombs in targeting residential areas. As the Saudi campaign against Yemen enters its seventh year, Yemen is saying Riyadh is still violating the international human rights law by holding 14 Yemeni oil ships amid the continued neglect of the international community. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
Japan's defense ministry says North Korea has launched a projectile suspected of being a ballistic missile. The ministry said the projectile didn't fall within Japan's borders or its exclusive economic zone. Earlier, the country's coast guard warned ships against approaching any fallen objects. South Korea's military also said the North had fired two unidentified projectiles into the sea. U.S. officials also confirmed a new projectile launch without giving details. The development comes after Washington and Seoul said North Korea had fired two short-range missiles on the weekend. The launches mark Pyongyang's first publicly known missile test since U.S. President Joe Biden took office in January. They also come days after U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin visited Japan and South Korea. Joining us is Jennifer Chang, our correspondent in Seoul. Jennifer, welcome. What message is Pyongyang sending out here? The first reported, perhaps more than likely, if confirmed, ballistic test since Joe Biden took office.
Well, we're seeing a rapid escalation in North Korea's provocations because on Sunday it fired two cruise missiles for the first time in nearly a year. And today, on Thursday, it fired two ballistic missiles, which are banned under UN resolutions. Now, the two cruise missiles were not banned under UN resolutions, but this was the first time in nearly a year that the North had fired cruise missiles. So that was considered quite disturbing. And today's missile launches are even more disturbing because ballistic missiles can actually carry a nuclear warhead. And these splashed right outside of Japan's exclusive economic zone in the East Sea. So this caused tremendous alarm on the part of Japan. The Japanese Prime Minister Suga was complaining about the missile launches today. And the South Korean military and Japan and the U.S., they are all watching these developments very closely because the U.S. is relying on South Korea and Japan to stave off North Korea's nuclear progress. And of course, half the troops that are trying to do that are stationed in Japan while the other half are in South Korea. So North Korea demonstrated that it can not only fire short-range cruise missiles that can hit any place in South Korea with tremendous accuracy, but now it's demonstrating that it can even fire a nuclear weapon all the way to Japan. And we are only a few months into the new Biden administration. This is going to be a tough problem for the Biden administration to tackle. But the North Korean first vice foreign minister, Choe Son-hee, had warned on Thursday of last week that the U.S. has to roll back its hostile policy. Otherwise, the North will never engage in any type of contact or dialogue with Washington regarding its nuclear program. The Biden administration has reportedly been trying behind the scenes to get the North to the bargaining table. And this has been going on for months now. The Biden administration has been in office since January. So now the Biden administration is about to reveal its review of how it's going to conduct its North Korea policy. It's holding a security meeting with Japanese and South Korean officials in Washington next week, and it's going to reveal everything that it's found from its weeks-long North Korea policy review. It'll be interesting how today's ballistic missile launches will affect that North Korea policy review.
No doubt that's going to play a part in it. Jennifer, thank you very much indeed for that. Jennifer Chang there, our correspondent, joining us from the South Korean capital, Seoul. Elsewhere, Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says the U.S. can't advance its agendas by keeping oppressive sanctions on Tehran. Majid Takhtarovanchi said 2 months into U.S. President Joe Biden's term, Washington is still in violation of the Iran nuclear deal and the UN Security Council Resolution 2231 that enshrined it. He blamed Biden for pressing ahead with his predecessor's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran while admitting its failure. Takhtarovanchi was responding to comments made by the U.S. Secretary of State. Antony Blinken has once again asked Iran to take the first step to salvage the 2015 nuclear deal.
While on a visit to Europe, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has been discussing the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, with senior EU officials.
I welcome the Secretary's reaffirmation that the U.S. is ready to engage and the prospects of a U.S. return to the JCPOA.
For his part, Blinken seemed only interested in spinning anti-Iran rhetoric following meetings at the European Commission Brussels.
We talked about our shared goal of preventing Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons.
Earlier at NATO headquarters in the Belgian capital, Blinken spoke at greater length on the subject.
To look at how we might come back to compliance with the JCPOA, we said yes, and to date, Iran has chosen not to engage. So as we've said, the ball is really in their court.
Even Iran's harshest critics might find Blinken's position difficult to grasp. After all, it was the U.S. that withdrew from the agreement in 2018 at a time when Iran was in full compliance, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency. Many analysts believe Joe Biden's administration is bowing to pressure from Tel Aviv to not engage with Iran. It has been suggested, however, that Benjamin Netanyahu does not speak for everyone.
There's many parts of Israeli society and even in the authorities that believe this deal will be better for Israel in the short, medium, and even longer term.
The U.S. continues to impose illegal unilateral economic sanctions on Iran, despite the JCPOA having been underpinned by the United Nations. Tehran insists the current deal cannot be renegotiated, and the only fair and legal option for the U.S. is to rejoin the accord without preconditions. As the coordinator of the deal, legal experts say the ball is firmly in the EU's court and not Iran's. According to many analysts, Iran has demonstrated it is unwilling to remain in the JCPOA at all costs. Therefore, they say, the EU is clearly running out of time to save this landmark agreement. Jerome Hughes at the European Commission, Brussels.
Political commentator Nick Ayala says the fact that the Biden administration does not want to return to the Iran nuclear deal shows U.S. politicians, Democrats and Republicans alike, are not after cooperation with Iran.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing the hypocrisy of the Democratic Party, and not just the Democrats, but all of the politicians in the United States. Like you mentioned, at one point, a year ago, they were out there criticizing Donald Trump for pulling out of the JCPOA. Now they are, and they ran a campaign really pushing for the renegotiation of the of the Iran nuclear deal. But what we're seeing now is, what's interesting is now you have a lot of many Republicans, part of the GOP, as well as even some Democrats who are now calling on Joe Biden not to rejoin or not to renegotiate the JCPOA. And that's, you know, that just goes to show that at the end of the day, it's not about, it was never really about trying to find some sort of dialogue or cooperation between the U.S. and Iran for many of these politicians. What it was about was enacting U.S. imperialism and the fear that Donald Trump was not following or towing the line of U.S. imperialist policy. So now these, you know, and so all these Democrats and even some conservatives went after him, attacking him, saying that he's not doing what you should be doing, what the established political operatives are already doing, you know, following through with the deal. Rather, he's going against it. Now they want to go against it because they realize that, you know, it's in their interest to be against any sort of collaborative efforts with Iran or any sort of dialogue.
Meanwhile, the Palestinian foreign minister has welcomed the adoption of the United Nations Human Rights Council's resolutions on the situation in Palestine. Riyad al-Maliki thanked all states which voted in favor of the resolutions. He also denounced those member states that voted against the resolutions as being aligned with rogue and outlaw regimes. One of the resolutions condemns the construction of Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem al-Quds. The other document emphasizes the right to self-determination for the people of Palestine. And the second wave of coronavirus has hit the besieged Gaza Strip. Daily COVID-19 infections have been on the rise over the past few weeks. This comes as the impoverished enclave lacks many resources to combat the coronavirus pandemic due to the crippling Israeli blockade in place since 2007. Ashraf Shannon has more in this report.
A new wave of coronavirus has started in the Gaza Strip, with over 500 new infections reported on Wednesday. During February, infections were below 100 cases daily. Coronavirus infections have reached over 60,000 cases in the blockaded Gaza Strip, mostly since late August 2020. Nearly 600 deaths have also been reported, amid shortages in medicines and hospital supplies, including vaccines. The unsteady supply of medical equipment and testing kits for COVID-19 has compounded the struggle of health workers in Gaza, undermining their efforts to contain and track the spread of the coronavirus.
We are witnessing an alarming increase in the number of daily infections. Coronavirus infections, current daily rate is over 500 cases. The number of patients requiring hospitalization and medical attention is also rising at a fast pace.
COVID-19 has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the impoverished coastal sliver, threatening the socioeconomic welfare of people in Gaza as much as their health.
We are afraid that the new coronavirus wave will result in new lockdowns that will only worsen the economic conditions. The situation is also very dangerous because of the high population density in the Gaza Strip.
The coronavirus is taking heavy toll on us because of the blockade and the lack of resources. Things are really tough, and we are in an urgent need of medicines, hospital supplies, and vaccines.
The Israeli blockade and multiple wars since 2007 have had a devastating impact on Gaza's health sector. Local authorities in the tiny enclave have been desperately fighting to prevent the spread of COVID-19.
Since early March, infections have started to rise. The first wave of coronavirus ended during February, and at that time the curve of infections was flattened. The results were also stable and the numbers of critical cases were moderate. During March, we started to witness a rapid increase in infections and critical cases.
People here are bracing themselves for the worst as COVID-19 infections continue to increase.
The small enclave has been under a crippling blockade since 2007. Experts say the Israeli siege must be fully lifted to help avert a humanitarian disaster. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
During the first 2.5 months of coronavirus vaccine distribution within the U.S., counties with higher levels of poverty and other indicators of socioeconomic vulnerability were inoculated at lower rates, a new analysis shows. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Kenny Stancil Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Poverty, a Key Driver in Vaccine Inequities. CDC report shows. Here's more. During the first 2.5 months of coronavirus vaccine distribution within the U.S., counties with higher levels of poverty and other indicators of socioeconomic vulnerability were inoculated at lower rates, a new analysis shows. The report, published recently by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention CDC, compares county-level estimates of first-dose vaccination coverage. The percentage of people in a county who had received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine between mid-December and early March, with county-level measures of social vulnerability. According to this study, COVID-19 vaccination coverage was lower in high-vulnerability counties than in low-vulnerability counties, a finding largely driven by socioeconomic disparities. Comprised of 15 metrics that are categorized into four themes, the CDC's Social Vulnerability Index, SVI, combines census data on key socioeconomic and demographic variables, including income, educational attainment, household composition in terms of age and disability, prevalence of marginalized racial and linguistic groups, and housing and transportation characteristics, in an effort to minimize suffering during disasters by improving communities' preparation for and responses to hazardous events, including epidemics. Last year, the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine recommended that the Department of Health and Human Services and state, tribal, local, and territorial governments use the SVI as a tool to ensure the equitable allocation of COVID-19 vaccines. Nationally, a total of 51,873,700 residents of 49 states and D.C. received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine between December 14 and March 1st, a coverage rate of 15.1%. The study found that vaccination coverage was higher in low-vulnerability counties than in high-vulnerability counties, although a few states had more equitable coverage and patterns varied further when indicators were disaggregated. For the overall SVI measure, there was a vaccination coverage gap of 1.9 percentage points between low vulnerability counties, that is about 15.8%, and high vulnerability counties, that is about 13.9%. While the general pattern of unequal inoculation rates was found across three of four SVI themes, some factors were associated with greater disparities. The most pronounced vaccine inequalities, for instance, corresponded with socioeconomic status, which yielded a gap of 2.5 percentage points between low vulnerability counties and high vulnerability counties. Among socioeconomic status indicators, the most impactful variable was the percentage of adults without a high school diploma, which was associated with a difference of 2.8 percentage points between low and high vulnerability counties. Meanwhile, for three indicators, population aged 65 and older, multi-unit housing and households without a vehicle, vaccination coverage was slightly higher in high vulnerability counties, while higher coverage in counties with large proportions of older adults was consistent with the prioritization of this age group early in the vaccination program. The researchers wrote, "The higher coverage in counties with lower percentages of households with a vehicle available was unexpected and warrants further investigation." With respect to two indicators, percentages of people with disabilities and individuals who speak English less than well, inoculation rates were roughly the same in low and high vulnerability counties, a finding the researchers described as encouraging in light of the disproportionate incidence of COVID-19 in these populations. Regarding the remaining 10 indicators, however, vaccination coverage was higher in low vulnerability counties, demonstrating that equity in access to COVID-19 vaccination has not been achieved nationwide, as the report's authors put it. For the overall SVI measure, vaccine inequities were found in 31 states, including 11 where disparities were identified in all four themes. Additional efforts are needed to achieve equity in vaccination coverage for those who have been most affected by COVID-19, wrote the authors of the report. Improving COVID-19 vaccination coverage in communities with high proportions of racial, ethnic minority groups and persons who are economically and socially marginalized is critical, they added, because these populations have been disproportionately affected by COVID-19-related morbidity and mortality. According to researchers, monitoring community-level metrics is essential to informing tailored local vaccine delivery efforts, which might reduce inequities. Public health officials can investigate whether disparities are occurring because of access problems, that is, vaccine supply, vaccination clinic availability, and lack of prioritization of vulnerable groups, or other challenges such as vaccine hesitancy, they wrote. Vaccination promotion, outreach, and administration might focus on high vulnerability populations within counties, that is, providing resources to federally qualified health centers when socioeconomic disparities are identified. Three additional states had higher vaccination coverage in high vulnerability counties than in low vulnerability counties for the overall SVI measure and in three of four themes. Alaska fell short in socioeconomic status theme, while Minnesota and West Virginia had shortcomings in the racial minority and language theme. According to the report, practices in states with more equitable vaccination coverage included prioritizing persons in racial ethnic minority groups during the early stages of the vaccine program implementation, actively monitoring and addressing barriers to vaccination in vulnerable communities, directing vaccines to vulnerable communities, offering free transportation to vaccination sites, and collaborating with community partners, tribal health organizations, and the Indian Health Service. After acknowledging the study's limitations, including state-level variations in prioritizing policies, a lack of individual-level vulnerability data, and the existence of intra-county inequalities, among others, the authors concluded with a recommendation. As vaccine supply increases and the administration expands to additional priority groups, the researchers wrote, CDC, state, and local jurisdictions should continue to monitor vaccination levels by SVI metrics to aid in the development of community efforts to improve vaccination access, outreach, and administration among populations most affected by COVID-19.
Food for thought.
Salam, dear listeners, and here is a wonderful piece of advice from the survivor of the tragedy of Karbala, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him. God says, O son of Adam, satisfy yourself with that which I have given to you, and you will be the most abstinent of people. O son of Adam, carry out the duties that I have made incumbent upon you, and you will be the best worshipper of people. O son of Adam, avoid acting matters that I have deemed forbidden, and you will be the most pious of people.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life. Keys of life.
Aksel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. Chapter 7 is an interesting topic, talking about clothes and the etiquette of dressing. We're on the topic of zina in chapter 8 and how we are able to adorn ourselves or beautify ourselves. And zina is important in Islam. It's something that should be a fundamental characteristic in a mu'min. We've mentioned a lot of things before, but here we're going to be focusing on how important it is a person to be presenting themselves in the best way possible. If you remember hadith from Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salam, where he would wear the best of his clothes for salah, and he justified that. He explained that when he was asked, why are you wearing the best of your clothes? He said, Inna Allah jameel yuhibbul jamal. From Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he also says, Falbas wa tajammal. Wear clothes and wear the best of your clothes. Fatajammal. Wear good, nice, elegant clothes. Fa inna Allah jameel yuhibbul jamal. Because Allah is beautiful and He loves beauty. He loves beauty. And then he says, Imam Sadiq salamullahi alayhi, he says here, Wal yakun min halalin. However, you need to make sure that it is halal. Halal here doesn't only mean that it is, for example, tahir, or it is from halal income or source, but it also means that it is within the boundaries of what it is that you should be buying in the first place. You need to make sure that it is free of any other kind of haqq that is entitled to anybody else, whether it be haqq of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, like your zakat or your khums, whether it be haqq of another person, like you not having returned back someone else's money, or whether it be the haqq of what it is that you are entitled to be spending, which means you're not buying something that is of luxury, you're not buying something with extravagance, with israf or tabdhir.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
In all, we understand that in this chapter, which is chapter number 8, a lot of these ahadith talk about a person avoiding being untidy, al-sha'ath, untidy or unclean or ruffled. You know, you need to always remember that, you know, when you are going to be wearing something, you need to make sure that, I hope that it's not ripped, I hope that it's not dirty, I hope that it's not too short or too long or too tight or too loose. You need to make sure that you are presenting yourself in a nice and positive way. From Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, when he was asked about the ayah خُذُوا زِينَتَكُمْ عِنْدَ كُلِّ مَسْجِدِينَ, which is in Surah Al-A'raf, ayah number 31, when he was asked about this ayah, خُذُوا زِينَتَكُمْ عِنْدَ كُلِّ مَسْجِدِينَ, he said, هو المشط عند كل صلاة فريضة ونافلة. It is you combing your hair, brushing your hair after every salah, whether it be a faridah salah or a nafila salah, whether it be a wajib salah or a mustahab salah, you should be combing and brushing your hair. We know that it is recommended for you to do siwak when you are praying after your praying. We also know that it is very recommended for you to be brushing your hair. You know, there are a hadith that speak about Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi seizing any opportunity to fix his beard and his hair. You know, that he would even look into water and use it as a mirror in order for him to brush and comb his hair. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, a believer has some of the qualities. And then he says, among these qualities that a mu'min has, tajammulun fi faqatin, which means that he should be beautiful, he should be presentable, he should be handsome, even though he is in need, in financial need, in financial dire, desperate, or poor. So, even though you are, for example, in financial restraint, you should continue to make sure that you are presentable. And here, tajammul, that you beautify yourself. There's many ahadith that speak about this sunnah of al-tamashshut, of combing and brushing your hair. كان رسول الله صلى الله عليه وآله ينظر في المرآة ويرجل جمته ويتمشط وربما نظر في الماء وسوى جمته فيه. He would look into a mirror and brush his hair and comb his hair and even look into water, into the reflection of water, and use that to brush and comb his hair. This is also another very interesting hadith that عن النبي صلى الله عليه وآله أنه لقد كان يتجمل لأصحابه. He would present himself in a beautiful way. He would present himself in a jameel way لأصحابه, to his companions. Fadlan ala tajammulihi li ahli, let alone him beautifying himself for his family, yani for his spouse. Wa qala inna Allaha yuhibbu min 'abdihi, indeed Almighty God loves from his servant. Idha kharaja ila akhwanihi, if he goes out to meet his brethren, and yatahayya lahum, for him to prepare himself for them, ويتجمل, and for him to be beautified, for him to beautify himself. والحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane. And you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
Minutes.
since the Cold War.
In mid-March, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson dropped the bombshell by announcing a 40% increase in the country's nuclear arsenal. Under the Integrated Review of Security, Defence, Development and Foreign Policy, the UK plans to raise the cap on the number of Trident nuclear warheads from 180 to 260 by the middle of the decade. Identifying Russia as the most acute threat to UK security, the Kingdom, according to the Integrated Review, will no longer publish figures on the size of its operational stockpile to maintain deliberate ambiguity for adversaries. This is the UK's first such increase since the end of the Cold War, making London look aggressive and hostile. The shocking point in the Integrated Review was that the UK would increase its arsenal of nuclear warheads not only to deter traditional threats, but also to confront biological, chemical, and perhaps even cyber assaults. The British government says the increase in warheads is in recognition of the evolving security environment, including the developing range of technological and doctrinal threat. Experts reviewing the language say it suggests in the event of a crippling biological, chemical, cyber or dirty bomb attacks on mass proportions, then Britain would consider a nuclear counterattack. Each warhead the UK holds is estimated to have an explosive power of 100 kilotons. By way of comparison, the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima at the end of the Second World War was about 15 kilotons. Trident warheads are loaded onto ballistic missile submarines as part of what London calls the country's nuclear deterrence strategy. At least one nuclear-armed sub is always on patrol. Asked why the British government wanted to end three decades of gradual disarmament, Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab answered, "Why? Because it is the ultimate guarantee, the ultimate insurance policy against the worst threat from hostile states." Minutes after Johnson unveiled the plan to lift the cap, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif condemned on Twitter what he called Johnson's utter hypocrisy, adding, "Unlike the UK and its allies, Iran believes nukes and all WMDs are barbaric and must be eradicated." Britain has faced a serious national emergency over the past year, whereas NHS nurses, the heroes of the fight, received a 1% pay increase in acknowledgement. London has found billions of pounds to spend on its armed force amid the pandemic, an issue that has caused a huge outcry in different political parties. A Green Party Member of Parliament, Caroline Lucas, called the increase a provocative, illegal and morally obscene use of resources. The Scottish National Party tweeted, "A shameful sum of money that could be used to tackle child poverty instead." Some other campaigners warned the UK was at risk of starting a new nuclear arms race at a time when the world is trying to emerge from the COVID pandemic. According to Kate Hudson, the General Secretary of UK-based Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, "This is no time to start a new nuclear arms race. As the world wrestles with the pandemic and climate chaos, it beggars belief that our government is opting to increase Britain's nuclear arsenal."
Earlier today, the Foreign Secretary justified breaking our nuclear non-proliferation treaty obligations on the grounds that nuclear weapons are, and I quote, "the ultimate insurance policy against the worst threat from hostile states." Well, the logical consequence of that position is surely that every country should be allowed to acquire nuclear weapons on the same insurance policy ground.
British governments always assert their commitment to the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, the NPT. And the integrated review is no exception. It states, we are strongly committed to full implementation of the NPT in all its aspects, including nuclear disarmament. That's while increasing Britain's nuclear arsenal violates the country's legal obligations under the NPT, which Britain ratified in 1970. The treaty requires countries that have nuclear weapons to disarm, and those that don't have them not to get them. So there is no way in which increasing a nuclear arsenal is legitimate under the treaty.
There's no real positive vision for anything other than a competitive future for a nuclear-armed Britain. How is the UK going to use this because this increased capital? Because one of the things this does do, of course, is increases the UK's negotiating capital if it were ever to be wrapped into any kind of multilateral conversation. So there is some upside here, but there isn't any real positive vision of how the UK would look to achieve that. And I think to the allies, the non-nuclear weapon allies that simultaneously value the UK's defence and their deterrence on their behalf, including nuclear deterrence, but have difficult domestic debates to manage around the legitimacy of nuclear weapons, that sort of absence of consideration will cause them a problem.
In the words of Stuart MacDonald, the defence spokesman for the Scottish National Party, for the Prime Minister to stand up and champion the international rules-based system before announcing in the same breath that the UK plans to violate its commitments to the International Treaty on Non-Proliferation beggars belief. Reversing the UK's course of consistent post-Cold War nuclear reductions, the integrated review is undermining the diplomatic image of the UK as the government paints a picture of a world with growing international competition and increasing threats from countries such as Russia, China, and North Korea. In terms of international disarmament diplomacy, the decision is unequivocally damaging to the UK's reputation. It will incur strong criticism at the upcoming Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference.
This statement is one more insight into just how hollow the brand of global Britain actually is. Because the Prime Minister's rhetoric always fails to come close to reality. Today, the Prime Minister preaches about international obligation, when only yesterday our closest partners in the EU are bringing his government to court for breaking international law. The Prime Minister talks about partnership with nations across the world in the very week that the most senior figures in the US, including the Speaker of Congress, warned against the UK's increasingly unilateralist approach. The chasm between the Prime Minister's rhetoric and the reality of his government's actions is deeply damaging. Just because he wastes £2.6 million desperately trying to copy the White House's press briefing room doesn't hide the reality of the UK's weakening global influence.
The integrated review comes at a moment of considerable change and disruption in the UK's nuclear warhead programme. The last year saw the announcement of a decision to build a new warhead, revelations about the UK's nuclear dependence on the US, and the renationalisation of the atomic weapons establishment. These developments, against the background of the coronavirus pandemic and Brexit negotiations, have passed with little parliamentary comment. In fact, the most significant change in the UK's nuclear posture in decades has still not been properly debated in Parliament.
Mr. Speaker, I voted for the renewal of Trident, and the Labour Party's support for nuclear deterrence is non-negotiable. But this review breaks the goal of successive Prime Ministers and cross-party efforts to reduce our nuclear stockpile. It doesn't explain when, why, or for what strategic purpose. So the Prime Minister needs to answer that question today.
Johnson's decision to increase Britain's nuclear arsenal poses a disturbing question. It's not just that the people would rather the money was spent on something more useful, or that this blatant breach of the NPT may encourage others to pursue nuclear weapons. It's a question of what kind of role Britain wants to play in the post-Brexit, post-coronavirus era, being prepared to spend billions of pounds on nuclear warheads. The British Conservative Party's long-standing love affair with nuclear power might trigger an uncontrolled arms race in a world more unstable and unpredictable than even during the Cold War.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
It is a profound misreading of history to expect Biden to turn his back on most of America's imperial behavior, says Joe Gill, writer, in an article titled Joe Biden and Decline of American Power. Stay tuned for more. The trade and political tensions that escalated under Biden's predecessor Donald Trump are set to continue. China's top diplomat Yang Jiechi has recently said the United States uses its military force and financial hegemony to carry out long-arm jurisdiction and suppress other countries. It abuses so-called notions of national security to obstruct normal trade exchanges and incite some countries to attack China. Biden's election was supposed to mark an end to the rogue presidency of Donald Trump, who left office after rallying his supporters to storm the Capitol building after refusing to accept he lost the election. But in many ways, Biden is Mr. Continuity, despite all the hype during his inauguration that the grown-ups were returning to the White House. It took newly elected Biden a little over a month before he authorized military strikes on Syria. A week later, Vice President Kamala Harris publicly declared opposition to a recently announced International Criminal Court ICC probe into the Israeli regime war crimes and crimes against humanity. The United States under Trump more than ever used its power nakedly to bully friends and enemies alike and to rip up international treaties signed by predecessors, such as the Iran nuclear deal. But it is a profound misreading of history to expect Biden to turn his back on most of America's imperial behavior. Whether it's the West Asia region, Russia, Iran, or China, the U.S. new administration is changing the language while keeping the substance. Last month, Blinken said Trump was right in taking a tougher approach to China, while Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo has said she will continue the Trump policy of using the full toolkit at my disposal to protect America and our networks from the Chinese. Dwight Eisenhower, who left the role in 1961, was the last U.S. president to seriously question the pursuit of military supremacy and intolerance of other ideologies and political systems.